Okay. All right, tonight we are dealing with, we're part of a five-class series. It's okay. Five-class series, we're in class number two. Major themes in the book of Bereshit, Genesis, and we're dealing with the famous sin between Adam and Eve, the apple, as people like to call it, and we're going to get into that and try to get a little more of a sophisticated understanding. And I will get you out at 10:15, as I always like to do. So last time I gave a homework out, which I got some response, some answers, a little on the vague side. So I dealt with a question about Tzelem Elokim, and that's a major concept in Judaism. So we want to double down and get that one right. Okay, so this is sort of the answer to the homework, so we're doing that in class together. So if you didn't do it, you can just type it up and then sit. Right, I just had this idea. Zing! This is genius! Anyways, all right. Let's have somebody read. We'll do a little reading action. Anybody know how to read here?
I can read.
Stephanie, well-renowned reader of text.
I think I can handle it.
Go ahead.
Expansion of last class, Tzelem Elokim.
Yes.
To clarify, humankind is unique in creation as a Tzelem Elokim, a mind with access to the divine craft, workman wisdom of creation.
Or basically, Basically, Tzelem Elokim means a mind that can access Hashem's thoughts, Hashem's wisdom, period. And we break it down to two different kinds of archetypes, which is sort of the question I'm trying to ask with the Steve Jobs and the Albert Einstein and this kind of stuff. Let's go ahead.
There are two distinct archetypes of people in whom this unique ability as a mind shows itself. Let's illustrate these archetypes. One, creative man. Tzelem can express its unique access to divine wisdom in creative production. Our understanding of divine wisdom allows us power to control and remake the world. Our creative application of wisdom is the source of a myriad of products, from the light bulb to the great symphonies and literature. Examples are Edison, Alexander Graham Bell, Mozart, Shakespeare, and Noah.
We'll get to Noah in a moment. Okay, yes.
Scientific man. Tzelem can also express its unique access to divine wisdom in the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake. Exploration of creation is thrilling and brings sanctity and profound meaning into the lives of scientific men. Examples are Einstein, Socrates, Euclid, Newton, and Adam, the first man. There is a tension between these two applications of mind. If Edison applies his mind to the problems of inventing the light bulb, he cannot put the same emphasis on pure research in space, time, and matter. The same applies to Einstein. To put emphasis on problems of space, time, and matter is to not put focus on the practical issues needed to invent a light bulb. The Torah discusses both types of Tzelem, creative and scientific. Noah represents creative man. Like Edison, Noah wanted to ease the life of his fellow man by invention. He discovered the plow, according to the Midrash, saving society countless hours of hard labor. Adam represents scientific man. Like Einstein, Adam explored the external world, seeking to name animals for the pure joy of understanding, without any particular application to controlling the environment. The rabbis note that this pure understanding brings sanctity and deep meaning, Shekhinah, into the marriage relationship. Does the Torah expect us to emulate Adam, seeking the sanctity and profound meaning of pure knowledge? Or are we to emulate Noah, seeking knowledge which allows us to ease the suffering of others materially?
Okay, so what do you guys say? So there's two, so let's just review. There's two archetypes, two categories of mind. There's sort of a practical-minded person who works at, technology, innovation, creativity, or what you hopefully do on your day-to-day in your job, or at least on good days. And then there's the people who are involved in abstract thought for its own sake. Okay? Thinking about the ideas without it being a tool to getting a promotion, without a tool of being noted as being a Nobel Prize. In other words, when Einstein was sitting there, by the way, the story of Einstein was that he did not get any job after he graduated college, university, no job as being a teacher. Forget about being a professor. I know this sounds ridiculous. Zero. He got through a connection. He had to need a connection to get a job in the Swiss patent office. He was a smart guy, as we later found out. He's able to do that work rather quickly to define, to distill the applications and figure out if a person is entitled to a patent. And he spent the rest of his time thinking about what's the nature of space and time. And then in around 1900, created out a number of papers that were revolutionary, changed the whole way. He wasn't doing it so he'd be recognized. He wasn't doing it so he would get a job. He was doing it because he was just intrinsically curious. Now, everybody here remembers, anybody here babysit a six-year-old kid? What is their number one question they like to ask you?
Why?
Why? And then you give them, Abba, why is the sky blue? Okay, which is not an easy question to answer. So, and then they ask you, whatever answer you're going to give, and then they follow up with their follow-up question?
Why?
Okay. You're going to get, at a certain point, says, because that's the nature of the universe as best I understand it. Go ask your mom. So, there's a natural curiosity to a child. They're not doing it because they are told to do it. It's not because of school. In fact, school kind of squishes that natural curiosity in many kids. They're just curious, exploring the nature of reality for its own sake. A natural, we've all gone to a museum or a zoo, and they're explaining about the nature of the particular creature, and it's like, it's just intrinsically awesome, not because I'll be able to win the next round of Trivial Pursuits or whatever just the beauty and the joy of understanding something that I didn't understand before. The joy of understanding. Okay? So you have two kinds of minds. There is minds that think of thought instrumental to production, technology, creating things, a creative mind. And then we call it a scientific, thinking it for pure thought for its own benefit. So the question is, what kind of Selim Elokim should we be? What do you say?
Why can't you be both?
Okay.
Like,
well, there is a problem, because if you're spending all your time on being, trying to figure out a particular project, which have a practical goal, it's hard. That person is like when, Alexander Graham Bell is working on having to do 9,000 prototypes for the light bulb. He's not going to be focusing about what's the nature of energy in his own right. So there are people that do both. There are people. But Judaism has a unique solution to this problem. The answer is to be both.
Balance.
How do you balance it?
In your head.
Boom! Shabbat. 6 days a week, we have an obligation to go out in the world and make it a better place. To use our mind to be creative. To be productive. In our jobs and the society in general. But in Shabbos, we leave our particular tasks and projects, and we mentally had the transit say, they're done the next 25 hours. And you start thinking about big picture questions. What's the nature of existence, reality? You should spend time on Shabbos about things which do not have a practical consequence. Big picture issues, okay? Learn what we call the ideal of Judaism. One of the ideas that Judaism brought to the world was learning for learning's sake. What we call in Hebrew, Torah Lishma. I seek the truth because it's for the truth. Period. So the answer is a balance. For 6 days a week, I gotta make a living. So if I'm a scientist, I gotta produce things. I gotta make the next Echo Dot. Because Alexa, play my Spotify list. Whatever, that we need to get that one down better. Whatever the technological thing, or we have to produce reports, or we have to meet with clients, or we have to get contracts out, whatever our job is, that's being creative, using our talent in a creative, practical, material way. And then there's using it for more theoretical pursuits. Do you understand that? Shabbos is the solution to this problem. So Adam Arishon, as depicted by the rabbis, was more, certainly when he was naming the animals, was a more theoretical thinker. Noah, who the Midrash says developed the plow, was a practical thinker. He also built the ark. So the idea is to be an Adam and a Noah. And that's the two facets of the Tzelem Elokim, of using your mind in two different ways. Okay, before I go on, is that clear? Does that help anchor the idea of what the Tzelem Elokim really is, the divine image? I want to, at the very least, make sure you don't think it's like it's a reflection of God, because God is not physical. He doesn't have a reflection. But it means that just as God is a free, quote-unquote, thinking being, we, on a limited level, reflect that. We are, by analogy, similar. But we're completely different. You know what I'm saying? There's a similarity. That's what means Tselem Elohim, image of God. Is that clear? So that's a major Jewish concept. You got to have that down. Question. Which was?
Ranking.
Yes, okay, now you can answer that question. How would you rank the fallen people? Steve Jobs, Einstein, Thomas Jefferson. Who else did I ask? I don't know. Okay, who would you put as Avraham Avinu?
What was the question? Which one of these is most?
We have most reflecting of Tselem. On the Tselemometer, where would you put as being a higher expression of Tselem?
Go with Avraham Avinu as number one.
Okay, so the why you see the person involved in creative thought is more involved in the concept of thought in its own right. You know what I'm saying? In other words, it has no, the objective of the thought is the thought, not the thought as an application. I can say, but that's really a higher expression of Tselem Elohim, really.
But you just said you needed both.
No, we are, realistically, we cannot be Einstein's or Aristotle's or Avraham Avinu. That's a very small, that's unrealistic. Those are one in a generation kind of people who can engage in their mind continuously like that. Adam is told, what is he told to do in chapter 1? Go out and conquer the world and subdue it to make the world a better place. Use technology. Use your skills to improve the world. Each person on their level. So you're using you're I mean, I'm sure everybody at work is constantly problem solving. That you're using your Tselem Elohim. You're trying to work out why is this happening? What's the cause? How can we intervene? How can we remedy the situation? That's using the creative. That's a creative mind. But a higher use of Tselem, a much more abstract, a higher level, certainly the scientific mind, that'd be a greater expression of Tselem. So Avraham Avinu, you might rank him as number one because he discovered God or rediscovered God. That was good.
So you're saying that sort of the pursuit of knowledge for knowledge's sake is a higher.
It's the highest goal of Judaism. You could say that is a feature of the highest. If a Jew is motivated by that, that person is a Jew living on the highest level. It's a feature of a Jew living on the highest level.
So I guess it would be the lowest.
Well, of those four people, yes. Because purely, like, I need a light bulb. Steve Jobs, I need to put all the music available to man on something this size. Because you never know when you need to know. You know what I'm saying? Now, we love it.
How is that more...
Tselem?
Yeah.
Tselemish?
Yeah.
Then...
I
think it's in the same level. I think it's it's a practical creation of helpful technology.
So it would be like Avraham Avinu, comma, Edison equals Steve Jobs.
If you're ranking Tselems, if you're taking out your Tselemometer, okay, put it another way, you put Avraham Avinu, you put Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. These were great minds of the Western world. Isaac Newton, Steve Jobs is giving you the iPhone. That's pretty good. But it's limited to as a tool of communication and entertainment. It's a limited. I mean, he didn't do it. He managed. He got smart people to do it. So you know.
But he gave Steve Jobs anything. He created it to try and get.
Well, I would say literally the reverse, because Avraham had no teachers.
Exactly.
So
he didn't get a direct word from Hashem.
But he discovered, in other words, the way that he's depicted by the rabbis is that he, in a certain sense, discovered Hashem from his own investigation.
True.
Which is from the natural order. True. Which is amazing. And not only that, he starts to engage in dialogue with the smart people of the thing, and then gets into the, and he starts to create a whole movement, which we call Judaism. But that's, you know, Steve Jobs is already existing within a whole technological, there's many generations of the computer already, and he's gathering.
He's just building on it.
Correct.
Avraham Avinu has to create it.
Correct. Using the classic metaphor of a dwarf on the shoulder of giants. Avram is the giant. We hopefully are going to be little dwarfs on his shoulders. Steve Jobs is a dwarf on giants of all the technology that have been developed, you know, of computers and all the microprocessing and all the different electronics that have been developed, you know, until the 80s, you know. Anyways, question yet?
So this idea of tzedem elokim that we talked about last week, I understand, you know, I thought it was about the creative man being the divine craftsman, the worksman, and I understand that. I don't understand how being a scientific man is in the image of God, because
yes,
we talked last week about how God is not pursuing knowledge because he's all-knowing, and that if anything, that's how he's, that differentiates him from man who can go from not knowing to knowing.
So good. So in a certain sense, we say tzelem elokim, which means literally the image of God or the reflection of God. It means that in some analogy, man and God have some sort of weak analogy. Okay, but yes, the way that we process knowledge and Hashem is different. Hashem and knowledge is one, and we go from a state of not knowing to knowing. But within the ranking of going from not knowing to knowing, who's a greater knower? The one who's just pursuing, you know, let's say a person who is like doing a Sudoku across the puzzle, person who's developing the iPhone, person who's figuring out gravity, or people talking about space and matter, or people who maintain that there is actually a metaphysical being that is responsible for existence. Rank those levels of thoughts. They're not the same thoughts. So you would say that the one, I just ranked them up there, so Avraham Avinu is superior to the person who's on the A-train, who solved today's Sudoku puzzle.
I know, they're pretty hard.
They are pretty hard. I'm not successful, but, you know, I'm not even on the list. Okay? So, you know what I'm saying? I don't know, is that clarifying? In other words, they're all use of mind, but the level of mindedness, due to its abstraction and more universality, is also a way to measure the significance of the thought.
Right.
How much of reality is it explaining? I've now figured out a way to put in an entire 30,000 songs on something this size versus understanding how gravity works throughout the entire universe. What's the larger concept? What's more universal? What's more pervasive? You're going to go with gravity.
The question was more around why is this an image of God? Why is this an image?
Because in a certain sense, God is the source of wisdom. So to the extent that we partake of wisdom to varying degrees. Now.
But isn't there like a limit to that? Like, you
have, yes, there is a limit.
People who like, they don't do anything in the world because they're just so in philosophical thought all the time that
right,
it doesn't actually. You're
correct.
Not part, you're not doing the commandment to Tikkun Olam.
Correct. Well, Tikkun Olam. No, you can be. In other words, if a person has ideas and they're teaching ideas, that is Tikkun Olam, because
that's true.
A person is if a person they call a thought leader, if they're teaching people how to live life better. And they're doing a TED talk that their idea that they thought about for 5 years that they discovered and they got it down to 18 minutes and they're sharing it on a TED stage and now 20 million people learn and improve their life. That is Tikkun Olam, even though he didn't build a house.
But I'm thinking more of like, you know, the person who, okay, they get their undergraduate and then they go for their master's and then they try to work and then they're like, actually, I'm going to go for another master's. And then
okay,
they end up with like 10 degrees.
Right, the perennial student. Right.
Yeah. I'm not talking about PhD students. That's a whole different concept that I
right,
very much in mind.
Yes.
I'm
right,
talking about people who get multiple degrees. I know people who have literally gone back to school like 6 times by the time they're 35. And you're like,
okay, so you're all right. So all right, look, I don't want to deal with the particulars. Yeah, there are people who could be avoiding reality. People who just love academic pursuit. Okay, so that's.
I did not mean that in a different way at all. I have so much respect for people who are in academia. That is not what I'm saying at all. You're still 25. Very different.
Anyways.
Sorry if I meant insult anybody.
No, all right.
That way about anybody.
Everybody, okay, all right.
Can I ask a question?
Please deflect and change the subject.
Sorry, everybody, if I insulted anybody.
Why? Okay, so the Shabbat piece of it.
Yeah, Shabbat.
But shouldn't there be like an encouragement to do the learning for the sake of learning, not just on Shabbat?
Yes. There's a mitzvah. There's a separate mitzvah. Excellent question. There's a separate mitzvah of learning Torah every day, which we're doing right now, hopefully. But there's a mitzvah, in a certain sense, when you learn Shabbos, when you learn on Shabbat, it's like a double mitzvah. Why? Because it's the mitzvah of learning, and it's also evoking the theme and goal of Shabbos.
But is this learning for learning's sake just when we're talking about Torah, or is it learning for learning's sake, like I want to read a book about astronomy and...
That is a super awesome question. So... there were those who felt that on Shabbos that they would specifically learn about physics. They learn about the creation. That would be a part of the, it would fit in thematically. As we say God, we say Kiddush, we lift the glass, we say Zecher L'Maaseh Bereishis, recalling the act of creation. So part of that is to learn about that. Some people say just to learn about the wisdom which is contained in the Torah. And it's certainly that the idea of Torah and general knowledge is not really two separate things, but really it's one continuum. Yeah.
So Einstein or Socrates, or right? Like they were thinkers.
Yes.
It wasn't just in Jewish thought.
Correct. No, they weren't involved in any Jewish thought.
Wasn't involved in any
correct.
Thought. So like the learning for learning is not just about
correct.
Like, even Shabbat or not Shabbat. Like that's
correct. 100%. So the answer is 100%. One of the mantras that we as Jews have is that we learn from anyone who has a good idea. Period. Jew or non-Jew, young or old, black or white, male or female, it makes no difference. A good idea is a good idea, and we don't care about the source. And it's a great and if Einstein had a great idea, we learn it, we celebrate it. Period. Okay. Just as a little point, this two identities of Tzelem Elokim. A little shameless plug in the bookshelf there. There is Rabbi Soloveitchik. We have to mention Rabbi Soloveitchik in every single class. You may have noticed at MG. Shameless plug. He wrote a book called The Lonely Man of Faith. It's about 120 pages or less. And he has two paradigms because, as you notice, there are two depictions of creation, chapter 1 and chapter 2. In his explanation of that, they talk about there's an Adam 1 and there's an Adam 2. And they reflect the two different, the creative man and the scientific man, okay? So in chapter 1, God commands Adam to go and conquer the world, subdue it. That's the creative man. And chapter 2, he's naming the animals in the Garden of Eden, okay? That's what they call Adam 2. All right. It's still very hot in here. Okay. Let's get into the actual, our goal of tonight. Who would like to read? Bereishis is chapter 2. Read this. 2:16. Let's Mariana.
God gave man a commandment saying, you may definitely eat from the tree of the garden, but from the tree of knowledge of good and evil do not eat. For on the day you eat from it, you will definitely die.
Okay, so stop. First of all, let me just puncture a curtain. When you think of when I say the word Garden of Eden, what are the words or images that come to your mind?
Trees.
Trees, good.
Grass.
Okay.
Spirit.
What?
Snake.
Well, that's a little later on. Good. I'll just tell you when I grew up, in my mind, I visualize sort of like a Club Med vacation. I don't know, it's just maybe it's a project. In other words, like people hanging out because it's a Garden of Eden, and you're just hanging out in like a deck chair. Fruity beverage, little umbrella.
I envision like it's like a square.
It's a square.
Closed in by like bushes that make this like tall bushes that make the square.
Okay.
And it's like.
But basically like Adam and Eve are just chillaxing. They're just like relaxing. Do you have any sense of just hanging out?
Chairs.
No chairs. Like, in your garden, there's no chairs. They really stand.
It's like Central Park.
You don't see chairs. What do you see?
I see greenery.
But what do you see Adam doing?
I don't see people.
There's nobody. You have a vacant Adam. You're Adam. Why not? All right. All right. Okay. Is Eve there? What does she look like? So she never shows up, and you're Adam. You're just waiting. You're just waiting on her to show up.
With Dolores or whatever.
With Dolores. you got the plus one going on there at the Garden of Eden. All right. Anyways. Maybe we're not going to explore this anymore. We're just going to... Anyways, I bring this up to your attention because when it, the text of the, I did not, you know, if you looked at the chapter 2, it says that God puts Adam in the Garden of Eden, la'avda u'lashamra, to work it and to guard it. So he's not there just hanging out, you know, just like doing nothing. In the eyes of Judaism, doing nothing is a disaster. Anybody know why? Why is doing, endless vacation, is that a good idea or a bad idea?
Bad idea.
Very bad idea. Why? Because you wake up every morning, most days, with a reservoir of energy. The energy has to find expression. The best expression is you're doing productive, creative work. Gives you purpose and meaning. You don't have that, bad things happen. You can have a vacation from work. You've been working very hard. You can have a vacation. You're exhausted to renew yourself, to revivify yourself. But you can't take a vacation from a vacation. Well, sometimes you do need it because sometimes the vacation becomes a job.
But for Israel, it's very
right. That was a very intense trip. But my point being, in other words, there is no idea of just hanging out. That's a bad thing because the energies of mankind, if they're not properly directed, will go into lower things. In other words, if you're not sure about that, just watch any of the documentaries on lottery winners. It is the saddest tale you ever going to see. The people who won lotteries, their lives were universally, except for very few, and they're the exceptions, were destroyed. Why? Because you have this blue-collar worker, middle-class person, who suddenly get $100 million. So now they have every choice. They don't have to work. They think that's a good idea. No, they just lost their whole purpose and direction in their life. And what are they going to do? So they get into, if they're guys. Because unfortunately, you can't just on a dime. If they were a learner beforehand, then they could do that. But you can't just become a person who's interested in ideas at age 40. It's game over. So they're going to go into drugs and partying. And they typically end up broke in three years, and bankrupt, and then having to go back to their old job. That's generally the pattern. Because you need to have a purpose, a focus, where your energy can be properly directed. We look at work being positive. Not in a pure tackle way that if you're not working, you're a loser. That's a Christian idea. We don't have that belief. But having proper use of your energies to create creative things is a good thing. Now, if a person's wealthy, doesn't have to work. There's still plenty to do to help the world out. They can use their energies in other ways, which are productive. But you have to use your energies in a productive, constructive way. Otherwise, the energy can go into bad places, drinking, womanizing, partying, drugs, disaster.
Do that without money.
Typically, a guy who's like making is a little bit, whose monthly budget is a little short and he's getting a little progressively into some credit card debt every month, which is most Americans, they don't have the freedom like, oh, I'm just going to take off my job because their whole life will fall apart.
I didn't say take off the job, I meant other things.
So they'll have typically enough discipline, they'll do it like on the weekend, you know what I mean?
Right. Okay.
But they have to get sober enough so when they walk in on Monday morning with a cup of coffee, they can function, kind of.
I can personally vouch for this. Things at work were very slow for a while, and there was enough that I couldn't really do other things, but it was the most miserable.
Right, you're bored and you're irritated.
But not only bored, it's like getting dressed, because I work remotely, it's like getting dressed in the morning gets hard.
Right.
It's like, okay, I'm just going to eat more.
You definitely
either. You start skipping social things. Like, you just become a
right. So, all right.
And I guess it's like you need
positive outlet. A positive outlet. 100%. Okay. Question: why would God give a rule that you can't eat something? He brings him into the garden and he says, "I'm going to give you one rule. You can't eat. You can eat from everything, but you can't eat from this tree."
Testing him.
What?
Testing him.
To what end? God obviously has all the knowledge, so you know you'll pass the test. Or fail, as the case may be.
To give him a sense of anxiety.
What's the value in that? God, so is God a sadist? He wants to let me torture you.
Free will, though. It gives them a sense of free will.
Well, either they have free will or they don't have free will. It's not going to give them free will. They have free will as a capacity to choose freely. But why? It's not going to give them free will.
It's a choice, right?
Yeah. In fact, the fact that they're giving a commandment shows that they do have free will, because if they didn't have free will, they either deterministically could not either avoid the tree or can't avoid the tree. If Adam was an animal, then the idea of a commandment would be irrelevant.
The reason that he gives the commandment is to show that
they have free will.
Free will.
Okay, that's a good idea. To what end?
What was their faith?
I don't know. God does it all the time.
To what end? You can't. If God, who has all the knowledge, he's not getting a new in order. He's not going to get a new insight. You're not like, oh, they fit.
Is free will and discipline the same thing?
What
is free will and discipline the same thing?
No.
Is it to teach them a lesson after they make a mistake? Like he knows they're going to make a mistake.
It's an interesting theory. But, I'm just taking ideas here.
Man, shouldn't also like it's a tree of knowledge.
Yep.
Get all the knowledge. It's like,
that's an interesting question. But isn't knowledge? We just had a whole conversation about Tzelem Elokim. Isn't knowledge a good thing?
Yeah, but you should have to work for it a little bit.
So then, work for
or
it.
Or be in the pursuit of knowledge. It shouldn't just all come to you because you're okay.
Okay, so I'm gonna give you guys a little hint of another pasuk. Verse. This is from Devarim. All right, who'd like to read? All right, who was reading before? Mariana, read.
You must carefully reflect on the fact that in the same way that a man disciplines his child, so God, your Lord, is disciplining you.
Okay. So here's a key point. This is a very critical verse in Devarim. The context of this pasuk is like this. The Jewish people, it's 6 weeks before Moshe's going to die. And he's giving his farewell address. And basically their 40-year travels in the wilderness was difficult. And giving a context for meaning. And he's basically saying, you must carefully reflect on the fact that the same way that a man disciplines his child, so is God your Lord, is disciplining you. So let's go. So Mary, read the two questions here.
Hashem disciplines us in the manner of a loving father. What educational purpose is served by giving humankind a prohibition to eat something? When a loving father disciplined his child with a death penalty.
Right, that's also pretty harsh. So let's do the first question first and the second question. So what if God is functioning as a loving father trying to discipline their child, what is the value of making a prohibition? What?
Self-control.
Okay, go ahead, expand upon that.
Obvious people need to exercise self-control.
Okay, so that's the key thing. In a certain sense, the first foundation... All of Judaism was basically reduced down to one commandment. It's a one mitzvah Judaism. Okay, it's pretty combat. And basically, you can't eat of this particular tree. Why? Because the key tool of having a relationship with God is discipline, which is self-control. It's not an issue of being... Now, what's in between discipline versus... self-denial or cause yourself or abstention. What's in between discipline versus abstention?
One M&M versus no M&Ms.
Okay. Right. That's a good example. No, but what is the principle behind that? No, I understand that. But why would a person have with one M&M? Because they're crazy. Right. That's like chocolate heroin. You're not going to just have one. You're doing the whole bag. But
you
have
self-control.
What? Why? But first of all, what is self-control? Let's define that. What is discipline self-control versus abstention?
Self-control is about waiting. So it's not that you're never going to have the thing that you're abstaining.
Why are you waiting?
I mean, it depends.
You just ate meat.
Okay, okay. That's a very, very specific detail. What is the problem? I'm asking you not what discipline is. I'm asking you what the principle of discipline. What's the principle?
The option's still available to you. You're just choosing not to use it.
Well, that's what's happening. But why are you electing to govern yourself in that way?
You're choosing not to do it right now because when you do it later, it's
going to
be better.
That could be one reason. But the principle behind that is that basically discipline is directing your impulses based upon a higher objective. So going back to your case, let's say I had a very good week. I'm doing my, I got my Weight Watchers app, and okay, I'm only at X amount of points, and I see I can reward myself with a couple of M&Ms. So that's a disciplined eating of M&Ms because I'm going toward a healthy lifestyle.
Right.
Versus, I'm depressed. I've had a rough day. I feel the world is kicking me in the tuchus. I sit down on my couch, open up the bag, zhink, hand, eating these like popcorn in front of a TV, and it's like over, and then I feel wildly sick. Okay. Nobody knows what I'm talking about. But fill in, you know, potato chips, popcorn. All right. So, okay. So the idea is that discipline is about governing yourself toward other long-term goals and objectives. Growth as a human is based upon this kind of discipline. What Hashem is trying to, Hashem is functioning as related to as a father to us as a kid, is trying to teach Adam, the first Adam, and Eve, the first man and woman, fundamentally to govern themselves in a disciplined manner, which is to avoid something for long-term gain. Okay, that's basically it. It's I'm not just sadomasic, you know, I'm not involved in sadomasochism by denying myself pleasure for its own sake. That's foolish. I'm not having this pleasure now because I want to have a better pleasure later on. That's what you were really pointing out. That's what discipline is. I am putting off immediate pleasure now for a long-term superior benefit later on. That's the principle that I'm operating on. Hashem is trading, that's basically what Judaism is all about. Discipline for long-term benefit. That's basically the whole. That's, you know, with a whole host of different things. Okay, let me get to the.
So, just go back to the apple.
Yes, the fruit, whatever it was, doesn't tell us what it was.
It was a discipline thing for what was God's reasoning.
The initial reason, or at least a reason, and there could be more than one reason. A reason is teaching and habituating them to a principle of discipline, in other words, of avoiding, well, he doesn't really know, we'll get into it, a harm for long-term benefit.
So it's basically by giving them something they should not do, giving them the opportunity to develop themselves.
In other words, he's putting them in a program of self of discipline and self-improvement. Now, it happens to be that we're going to see right now that this actual item that he wanted them to avoid actually is harmful. It wasn't good stuff. It was actually a bad stuff. We'll actually have to analyze it. We have 12 minutes. Okay. So let's see if we can get it down. All right, let's read out the little episode here. Okay, Marianne, you're doing a great job. Flip the page.
Nahash.
It translates, Nahash is translated either as snake or serpent, but that's not really going to, we'll see, that's not clearly what it really is. Go on.
All the wild beasts that God had made. The Nahash asked the woman, "Did God really say that you may not eat from any of the trees of the garden?" The woman replied to the Nahash, "We may eat from the fruit of the trees in the garden, but of the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, God said, do not eat it and do not even touch it, or else you will die." The Nahash said to the woman, "You will certainly not die. Really, God knows that on the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you become great leaders, knowers of good and evil."
Okay. So first of all, just some basic fact. What's the Nahash? So there's two camps among the commentators on the Chumash. One maintains, Ibn Ezra maintains, that it was a sophisticated being, actually it's kind of very contemporary, sort of the missing link. In other words, it was a walking, talking creature that able to reason, but did not have a Tzelem Elohim. It had intelligence, didn't have a Tzelem Elohim. It's like a Neanderthal without a soul in that sense, okay? And this form and other, the Nahash is not really an external being. It's really what? It's internal. It was her own, what they call Yetzer Hara, her evil inclination that was her own internal debate with her lower impulses. Okay. Now, all right, let's do some, all right, read the questions. Let's read some questions there. In either event, pick it from there.
Ibn Ezra.
No, skip that away. I just summarize that.
Okay, how does the nauseous strategy of having Eve repeat Hashem's prohibition to reveal a sophisticated understanding of influence?
Okay, stop right there. In other words, why does he go to her and say, oh yeah, by the way, can you have this, what does he say? He says, did God really say you may not eat of any trees of the garden? What's anybody does sales knows exactly what's going on here. What's his first step
you're
in that?
You're looking for the no, so you can.
What? But what's his first step?
Reverse psychology.
Well, first asking.
Discovery questions.
All right, just taking out, just open a question. Oh, did God really say that you can't eat of the tree in the middle of the garden? What is he wanting to get? What is he seeking? Every manipulator, seducer. What? Well, but what is he trying to elicit from her? What is he trying to find out? Sleazy guys do this.
Yeah.
A reaction? Like where you stand.
Right, where you stand. Otherwise known as point of weakness. You get the person talking, and then you hear, listen carefully, what are they saying? And what was her point of weakness? How did she depict the prohibition?
She's going to die.
Well, that's what God said, but did she? Is it identical to what Hashem said? What did she say? What did she do? She said, don't eat of it, do not even touch it, or else you'll die. Is that what God said to her? Or to Adam?
No.
What did she add or subtract?
The touching.
The touching part. Interesting. So she made it. She added on to the prohibition. Says you can't eat it and you can't even touch it. Now, if you know a little bit about psychology, how did she start? What does that mean that she's relating to this object?
She wants to touch it.
She wants to touch it because she's made into a taboo object. This is where in literature we call it the forbidden fruit. This is literally the source in literature. So she starts to relate to something having a mysterious, poisonous, yet attractive quality to it. The Nachash, of course, hears that, says, and then what does he do? He hears the weakness, and what does he do with the weakness? He exploits it. Okay, this is right. Have you met salespeople like this? Yes. Where he says, you certainly will not die. Really, God knows that on the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be open. You will become great leaders, knowers in good and evil. Okay? So he basically, he senses that there's a weakness there, that she has a sort of very immature idea about it. Chazal say, the rabbis tell us on this thing, they say, kol ha-mosif goreya, whoever adds subtracts. She added to the mitzvah was not to eat it. What did she add? Don't touch it. When you start,
do that all the time with all the fences they put up?
No, because they're not saying that. No, they're saying that. No, adding. They're not allowed to add to the Torah. They're saying this is the Torah law. We're making a rabbinic fence. She's making the original command something else. Now, what
if she had said, "But I won't even touch it just in case"? Then it
that's still an issue. That means.
Offense.
If she would have said,
but she's not betraying
it. If she said, this is forbidden, we can't eat it, and if we do eat it, we're going to get it. And personally, as a personal fence, I am not going to even touch it. That would be better. But she's not. She's already psychologically merged her own psychological connection to the fruit with the original divine command. Okay, made it. In other words, he didn't say this is an evil fruit. This is not poison. He's not saying don't eat plutonium. He didn't say that. So she's projecting on God's command herself, which of course the Nachash picks up the weaknesses and exploits it, because that's what a manipulator, seducer, exploiter does. Let's go on. Then the Torah goes super slow mo on verse 6. Let's take a look. Well, actually, no. Read question number 3. It's a good question.
Receptive to his rebellion against Hashem or not?
What do you say? Did he think that she was going to be receptive?
Yes.
Why? He just knew. He just knew.
Otherwise, why would he be even...
Okay, first of all, that's true. Obviously, he's not going to bother with somebody he feels is not really open to a suggestion, A.
He's enticing her.
Yeah, but you don't. It's not like a magic thing. How is he enticing her?
It's saying if you do it, then your eyes will be opened and you will become...
Right, so he senses from them, the fact that that's his pitch, he senses what? That's what she wants. He senses the weakness, senses what the psychological structure is, and feeds it back to her. Chazal point out that the question is, why is he not talking to Adam? We don't have extra time here. He was also sexually interested in her, according to the Midrash. Okay, we're out of time. Yeah, there's all kinds of good stuff here. But we continue.
Yeah, but if it was internal, how does that
work? That matter does not hold like that position. Okay, that has to view that. That has to go by the external side. Correct. Good question. Verse 6. Okay, let's keep on going.
The woman saw that the tree was good to eat and desirable to the eyes, and that the tree was attractive as a means to gain intelligence. She took some of its fruit and ate it. She also gave some to her husband, and he ate it. The eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized that they were naked. They sewed together fig leaves and made themselves blindfolds.
Okay, so now she looked at the fruit, and suddenly she noticed something which apparently she had not noticed before. She saw A, it's good to eat, B, desirable to the eyes, and 3, attractive to mean to gain intelligence. Why didn't she notice it any other day?
She didn't have the knowledge.
Why did she get more knowledge now? What changed?
The snake sent some stuff to her.
The snake did send some stuff to her. Correct. He put some ideas in her. Now, he noticed, he says, on the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you'll become great leaders, knowers of good and evil. So what emotion is he drawing upon? What fundamental desire of mankind is that? One word answer. But what are they coveting? He's telling her, if you eat of this, you're going to be great leaders, knowers of good and evil.
Power. They didn't actually get any knowledge. It's just
we're going to get to that. Okay, hold on, Scott. You're going ahead. You're going ahead here. He's telling them that if you have this fruit, you're going to be empowered. You're going to become great. This knowledge is going to provide you great knowledge of leadership. So then she starts to re-examine the fruit, and she starts to look at it a little more carefully. She starts to think, first of all, she notices there's 3 qualities. One, it's attractive. Right, it's good. First of all, it's good to eat. So it's from a sensory, immediate thing. This is good stuff. 2, it's good to eat. It's desirable to the eyes, aesthetic, and last thing, it's a tool of intelligence.
Question.
Yes.
I don't know what the Hebrew is like, but the fact that it says the woman saw that the tree was good from an English perspective is very similar to, and he saw that it was good. And
oh, that's good. That's a good observation.
So in the sense that she's assuming a power that isn't hers, she's kind of assuming a position of godliness. And, I mean, you could almost think of it as...
Well, she's...
She elevated herself to...
Or she's trying to.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Not like...
Right, not in
like
reality.
She actually did it, but in her mind...
Correct.
Playing God.
That's a very good observation. It's a very good observation. Now... I want to share, being that we're down to 1 minute, so I really need 7 to 8 minutes, but I'm going to do it down to 60 seconds because it's 10 o'clock and it's very hot. 10:15 is very hot in this room. Everybody's like, because you pour some more water on the rocks, I just feel, anyways. Here's the point. Basically, the knowledge of good and evil that Hashem wanted to restrict them from was basically, they were at this point, in a certain, back to our idea of Tzelem Elokim. They're basically, in a certain sense, scientific-oriented. They're appreciating Hashem's wisdom for its own sake. But then there is using God's wisdom as a tool for what? Power and pleasure. There are many intelligent people in the world, but they use their intelligence for what purpose? Gratifying very basic desires. Food, sex, power, aggression. Basically, you know, that's it. And basically, the eating of this fruit would move them into a new area, where they'd be using their intelligence, their God-given intelligence, for the first thing, it was good to eat, the sensory experience. Then there's the aesthetic experience of it looks beautiful. you know, just for you know, for beauty, for beauty as a good, and ultimately as a way of empowering them to use their intelligence to, you know, in a pragmatic way to maximize their, become great leaders. In a certain sense, the Nachash was correct, but he was causing them to destroy themselves. In a certain sense, they did die that day because they became different people. They were exalted people and became now focused, using their intelligence for basic power and pleasure. And that was a great reduction. That's what they call the fall of man. Now, Christianity says the fall of man is so vast that they're unredeemable without the saving grace of Jesus Christ. We maintain man is savable, but it's hard, and it's called tshuva. You can save yourself. There's a very big debate about that. And that fundamentally is what's happening. It's not about special magic bean fruit. It's about the fruit that's going to move them into a new realm of looking at the world. They had a, beyond had a, had a, had a grandiose, big picture perspective of a scientific, just exploring for, like, the creativity of a 7-year-old, just the joy of exploration and curiosity. And they go into a person who you meet every day, who intelligence and wisdom is just instrumental to immediate gain, pleasure, power, advantage, done. And that was a big, and that's a big, and that's a big reduction of man. Okay? That's a 67. All right. There's more here, but that's all we got. All right, guys, have a good night. We will continue next week.